Good morning, Prince George. This is Uncle Don again with Uncle Don Reads the Comics, a half hour of facts, hoaxes, and anecdotes. You figure which is which. It's a fine autumn day in Prince George as the world teeters on one side or the other of another war. Get your programs. You can't tell your wars without a program. Combat du jour. Who are they attacking today? Will Canada join in or be content to sit on the sidelines and sell ammunition? Stay tuned. This is CFUR, campus-based community radio at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Right here, I want to make an impromptu pitch to the students at UNBC. There's a referendum going on today and tomorrow that will have a great bearing on the existence of CFUR. It's in favor or against a $5 deduction per semester, a refundable fee that will help finance CFUR. If you're in favor of keeping CFUR on the air, please come and vote yes in this referendum. Shall I start right in on George Bush today or give him a rest? I think I will save him for later and begin with a piece of unwanted advice. Don't marry early, unless, that is, you intend to marry often. From what I've witnessed, those who run off straight from school, all misty-eyed, in love, and overwhelmingly horny, will not last long together. It'll come to a point where familiarity becomes boring and both parties will blame the other for lost opportunities. As soon as you hear that phrase, "If it hadn't been for you, I could have," the relationship is over. Get out and see the world, what the world is all about, before you make any vows. A rolling stone gathers no moss, nor can you hang a wedding ring on it. With luck, you'll have plenty of years of life to settle down into a boring routine. It should not happen to anyone in his or her 20s. Ah, but I want to have all of my babies while I am young. Okay, here's another bit of shocking information. There are already 6 billion-plus people overburdening this lovely planet. This world is not crying out for your offspring. Go childless or adopt someone else's mistake, and there's plenty of time for either. As a resident of Canada, you have opportunities not available to most of mankind. You live in a country where it is easy to get a passport and to accumulate enough money to travel. As a speaker of English, or are you just listening to CFUR for background noise, you can get along in most countries fairly well. So what are you waiting for? Okay, get as much education as you want or can afford, then see some sights. Even if you just travel across Canada, you will be seeing a good chunk of the world's geography and meeting some good people. Footloose. For many years, I heeded my own advice and avoided marriage. In fact, I used to denounce the institution until I was hooked, or was hooked. It was a matter of perspective. When I came first to Canada, I found work in Sudbury. This was during the Vietnam War, and I joined the flood of young men moving to Canada at that time. Although I did not have to avoid the draft, being a veteran, I did want to escape the war culture down south. Then, as now, I carried on a voluminous correspondence with people all over the world, because postage used to be cheap. I told everyone that they would not be able to reach me for a while as I was going underground. For some reason, some correspondents misunderstood and were quite disappointed when they found out that I was working as a miner. So how underground can you get? Some people, eh? After 5 months of wrestling with a jackleg drill, waiting to be crushed every working day, and living in a boarding house, I was open to an invitation to change my life. Just around this time, in 1968, things were brightening in the States. It looked like Eugene McCarthy was going to take the Democratic presidential nomination and defeat Lyndon Johnson. The Vietnam War was going badly for the States, and it seemed Johnson was going to have to give it up. It was one of those rare windows of opportunity when things looked like they were changing for the better. The promise turned out to be false, but no one knew that then. At this point, an old school friend who had moved to California asked me if I would like to go there and join him. While I was considering this offer, I had a bad day on the job. I was stoping, that is, driving a shaft upward in an area where the seams of rock were nearly vertical. My partner and I tried to knock the loose rock down so we could drill into hard rock, but every place we hit with the bar, more loose rock came down around us. I said that for 2 cents I'd quit the job right there. He dug 2 pennies out of his pocket and called my bluff. I took his 2 pennies, which I still have, found the shift foreman, and quit on the spot. I took the next cage to the surface, collected my pay, and said goodbye to beautiful Sudbury. I paid a brief visit to my parents in New Jersey, where I worked at getting the embedded grit out of my pores before finding a ride west with 2 sisters in an aging Volkswagen. The older of these two was married to her true love back east and settled into a life of marital bliss when the man came and took her lover away. It seems he was a prison escapee from California, and they took him off to finish his sentence. His wife was taking this trip to be close to him. Touching. The trip was not much for laughs, as the car refused to exceed 59 miles per hour, and neither sister was full of scintillating conversation. The one bright spot was when we stopped in Las Vegas. Now, this was back in the dark days when gambling was still illegal in most states except Nevada. The women wanted to do some gambling, but they had very little extra money, so I was entrusted to hold all of their money, but that allocated to be blown. They hit the slots before while I hit the bar. Before long, they came looking for me. They had run out of money and wanted a few dollars more until their luck changed. I refused. They got nasty. They accused me of taking their money. I refused. They offered to call a cop. I refused. They went into their room that night, bitter and angry. The next morning, on the road out of that garish dump, they both thanked me graciously. So we arrived in California, and I made my way to Oakland, where my friend was holed up in a rented cottage with his chosen mate of the day. Since I had last seen my friend, Bob, he had become immersed in Scientology while supporting himself by selling bed sheets in flea markets. He was still my old friend underneath the veneer of quasi-religious rebirth, but his partner was Scientology to the core, and she had been a founding member of the Sexual Freedom League in the Bay Area. This was an organization of losers who could not find sexual partners without an organization. For the few weeks I spent as their guest, she spent a portion of her time trying to convert me and the rest trying to seduce me. Beside the fact that she was the alleged partner of my friend, I found her repulsive. When I found a job and could get my own apartment, life became a lot easier. I hung out in California for a couple of years, managing to avoid permanent sexual entanglements and savoring that wild society before events drove me to seek adventure further south, in Australia. Ah, retirement leisure. If you are lucky enough to live through your travels and survive your working years, you may retire and not have to answer to fools anymore. If you are now young, you may not have this opportunity, as pension plans are being sabotaged by corporations and governments. Now that we have reached a level of productivity where we could supply all of our needs with everyone working a four-hour day, those who are working are expected to put in unpaid overtime and work until they drop in the traces. Those who are not working are considered lazy and undeserving of any income. It's feast or famine. But I digress. My ambition upon retiring was to return to university to learn the things that I had missed the first time around as I was too busy studying. UNBC opened just in time, and I've been auditing courses since 1994. Finally, I can pursue things that interest me without having to worry about making a mark. I have a difficult time empathizing with students here at the university who do not care about course material but are still just trying to do the minimum work to get by. Perhaps I just don't remember what it was like when I was an undergraduate. It was disheartening the other day to sit in class when the professor came in and said, "Good morning." The reply from one of the students was, "Will that be on the exam?" Now back to the real world of 2002. The Bush regime is still making a lot of noise about the dangers of biological weapons of mass destruction, or NMDs as they say in the war biz. Some of the edge has been taken off the anthrax scare once it was revealed that the deadly toxin came not from some sinister dusky Arabs, but from the U.S. Army's own labs. And they still have not been able to trace the source beyond that, since there were so many laboratories working with that particular strain. Makes you wonder, eh? United States is a signatory to the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention, which has also been ratified by 143 other countries. It is firmly established in international law. But international law and agreements are a hindrance to Bush rather than a framework within which to work with the world community. There have been ongoing international discussions on how to strengthen the convention, but the United States shocked its allies and others by saying it wants to delay further discussions until 2006. Bush and company don't seem to think that it is important to have international controls on biological weapons, while at the same time claiming that Iraq has a program of developing such weapons, along with Iran, North Korea, Sudan, Libya, and Syria. In digging behind this news, we find what the real problem is. It seems that supporting this international convention would mean that the United States would be expected to abide by it and cease developing biological weapons. By gods, we can't have this. Don't these other countries know that the United States needs these weapons for defensive purposes? All American weapons are purely for defense, right down to the lowly B-2 bombers that will be circling the globe to rain death on Iraqis. Defensively, of course. If Iraq is allowed to develop biological weapons, it might use them to make invading American soldiers sick. We can't have that. Better to destroy Iraq now and keep all of those soldiers from getting the sniffles later. Just as Butch is bribing, threatening, and blustering to look for any allies in his defensive war against Iraq, out comes another nasty leak from the Pentagon. This document, called the Nuclear Posture Review, tells us that American nuclear missiles are now targeting seven countries in which they must be ready to use them. These countries are Russia, China, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Syria, and Libya. By coincidence, there is a large overlap with a list of countries that Bush claims are developing biological WMDs. And American policy no longer claims that nuclear weapons will only be used as a last resort after someone else uses them. What's the use of having 30,000 or so of these weapons if you have to wait for someone else to start the war? Now they plan to use them freely if they are frustrated by other methods of conquering countries without loss of American lives. British Labour MP Alice Mahone has been quoted as saying, quote, "The lunatics have taken over the White House. This report must be ringing alarms throughout NATO," unquote. That may be, but I can quickly name seven other countries where the alarm bells are ringing right now, and two of them have a veto in the United Nations Security Council where Bush is trying to get approval for an attack on Iraq that we will see one way or another. The lunatics have taken the White House, indeed. While the Pentagon is planning for nuclear war and the U.S. is fretting over the biological weapons of its many enemies, there are reports of new developments in the research front. According to the Sunshine Project, an NGO that watches weapons development, the Pentagon is working on offensive biological weapons that are based on genetically engineered microbes that attack items like fuel, plastics, and asphalt. Spread these bugs around the enemy countryside and their toys dissolve into mush. Sounds like a great way to a bloodless victory, but there are a few shortcomings. First of all, such developments violate domestic and international laws, but we know how much respect the U.S. has for either of these impediments. The U.S. loves to cast stones at others and rail about their weapons, while developments like these that violate the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention are overlooked. Aside from the technicalities of international law, what happens if these little bioengineered marvels decide to spread from a future battlefield? Suppose one of these bugs takes a hankering to plastics out of the target area. If a bug with a taste for polyvinyl chloride comes to our town, we'll be swimming in a sea of goo and we could expect to starve or freeze in short order. But it is all for the cause of freedom and democracy and capitalism, so what the hell? California. So I dug my roots into California and I began to think and act like a Californian. You have to realize that to become a Californian, you have to suspend your values and become immersed in an alien culture. It is not like any place else on Earth, or at least it was not in the 60s. I found myself in an embarrassing situation involving a friend, his wife, and some details I would rather not broadcast. While we were attempting to work out a solution that did not involve weapons, we became aware of a uniquely Californian institution that was growing in Oakland that called itself Synanon. Synanon had begun with a bunch of men for whom AA did not provide an answer to alcoholism. It centered around a variety of attack therapy, which they came to call the Synanon game. Synanon grew to be a residential program that embraced those with any kind of chemical dependency. It only accepted candidates who had reached a point where they were desperate for a way to break away from alcohol or drugs. Candidates for membership had to go through a grueling and humiliating initiation to prove their dedication. Then they began working at the lowest jobs, cleaning toilets and such all day and half the night. This Marine Corps-inspired treatment gradually was lifted, and initiates were given more responsibilities and freedom. By the time they had climbed above the hazing period, they had invested a lot of themselves in the project, and most did not want to gamble what they had gained by dabbling in their old ways. As it attracted more members and proved itself successful, it branched out and began running small businesses like a gas station and manufacturing of small novelties. They acquired some real estate, which included a former exclusive club in a part of downtown Oakland that had deteriorated badly. This was no small structure. It covered a city block and boasted an Olympic-sized swimming pool on the sixth floor. The binding factor in the success of this growing enterprise was that the attack therapy, which they called the Synanon game. Around this time, as the three of us friends were trying to work out our troubles, Synanon decided to open up their games to the community in a very limited way. A couple of nights a week, outsiders were allowed into the downtown building to participate in the games under the guidance of resident Synanon members. I have no idea whether others have experimented with this type of attack therapy, but I will testify that it worked as I saw it. About a dozen people would sit in a circle and begin a light banter. Someone might say to another that his socks did not match. The target would then defend himself by saying, perhaps, "Yeah, he got dressed in the dark." "Are you afraid of the light for some reason?" one would ask. Then it would build until the target was fending off criticism of all sorts from all comers. It reminds me of a motel print of a deer attacked by a pack of wolves. There were only two rules to the game: no violence and no threats of violence. When one target was exhausted, sometimes reduced to tears, the attack would switch to one of the previous attackers, and it went on that way until everyone had had his or her turn in the barrel. The whole process was the damnedest thing I have seen, as there seemed to be a catharsis involved that cleansed away a lot of pent-up garbage in people's heads. And the fury of the game did not last beyond the game room. 5 minutes after people were screaming at each other, they would be calmly drinking coffee and talking about the weather. We participated in these games for a couple of months until it seemed that patterns were repeating themselves and we dropped out. I do feel that it did everyone involved a lot of good. Unfortunately, Synanon is now dead. From its promised start, it developed into something of a cult around the founder, a decidedly again. It seems that Vancouver Whistler has one fewer competitor in its bid for the 2010 Winter Olympics. The good citizens of Bern, Switzerland, voted in a referendum to reject their city's bid as the venue for the Games. They showed the common sense not to listen to the business types who would have made money from this circus at the expense of the citizens. We in British Columbia will not have a chance to vote on whether we want this 2 weeks of jock contests at a cost of billions of dollars. Somewhere back in recent history, the BC Liberals and the Fraser Institute declared that we are not citizens anymore, but taxpayers. Watch the news and see how often we are referred to as taxpayers. There's a great difference between citizens and taxpayers. Citizens have rights. Taxpayers have responsibilities. Again, modification of language is warping our thinking. Offshore oil. No worries about the cost of the Olympic Games in 2010. By the time we will be awash in oil revenue, Kuwait North is what British Columbia will be. No problems. But let us stop smoking that BC bud and look at the reality. A small news item buried in the paper on the 23rd quotes a Shell Canada geologist as cautioning us on our optimism. At a natural gas conference in Vancouver, this chief geologist told the audience that offshore resource estimates have been misunderstood. The Geological Survey of Canada estimates 9.8 billion barrels of oil and 25 trillion feet of natural gas reside in the Queen Charlotte Basin. This estimate is for in-place resources, that is, the total that is down there. This has very little relation to what could be considered reserves. He said a rule of thumb is that about a quarter of the oil resources and 70 to 80% of natural gas resources are recoverable. And then there's the cost and expense of drilling in one of our roughest bits of ocean. We may find that the oil companies say no thank you to our government's offers of drilling rights. This geologist warned his audience that reserves in the Queen Charlotte Basin are only conceptual. I think that means geologists speculate about them being while toking up their own bud. Public-private partnerships. The salvation of our cash-strapped government will be the much-vaunted P3. Yes, public-private partnerships will allow the private sector to use their expertise to build infrastructure which can then be paid for by being leased to the government or by user-pay schemes. Now that the government no longer needs to build schools, hospitals, roads, sewers, water supply, or hydro stations, taxes for us, particularly the rich, can drop to almost nothing. Wow! Now you will have minuscule taxes, but you will pay for all schooling, hospital care, road tolls, water, and sewer. Got any idea who comes ahead in this scheme? It is those rich bastards who have been hiding in their manicured gated communities who already have their own police and utilities. They get their taxes cut, yet again, and offload the cost of public services down to the working classes. But what the hell? It always works and private enterprise is more efficient and cheaper. Right. Which brings us to another little news item. BC Hydro, at the behest of the government, entered into a P3 deal with Calpine Corporation to build a natural gas-fired power plant in Nanaimo. Calpine just backed out of the deal, leaving BC Hydro holding the bag for another $190 million. Now I'm waiting for the estimates of how much more this is going to cost than it would have cost for BC Hydro to just take on the whole job from the beginning. Yes, public-private partnerships will be our salvation. Murder and Terror. Since civilizations have arisen, men have recognized that people have to be restrained from killing one another. Throughout history, civilizations have had penalties for those who murder and provided alternative methods of settling disputes. No ruler wants to have his subjects slaughtering each other. It is hard on the victims and unsettling for the survivors. We can trace these restrictions on murder back to the first civilizations in Mesopotamia, a country we now know as Iraq. Killing is prohibited in the Bible by the unambiguous admonition, "Thou shalt not kill." Of course, the Judeo-Christian God had an exemption from this rule, and the Old Testament is full of divine mayhem and murder. Keep this book away from children. It's still the same in our secular society. Individual civilians are prohibited from killing one another, while we have a class of soldiers and police who are paid to kill for us. They're not given a free hand to do this, except in Los Angeles and Colombia. Murder in Canada is seen as an affront to the Queen, who might be put off her crepes by the news of the citizens slaughtering each other without the sanction of governments. Growing in parallel with domestic law prohibiting killing and regulating other relations among citizens of independent political entities was a body of agreements, treaties, and understandings between these political bodies. These have been traced back to around 3000 BC in the Near East, Persia, and Greece. Since these states have developed a body of customary and written understandings that have become known as international law. This international law is very different from domestic law, as it lacks the enforcement means available for enforcing domestic law, as there is no international cop, not until the United States appointed itself to that position, that is. After Germany, Italy, and Japan ran amok in the last century, the victors of World War II agreed to establish an international organization that could provide a peaceful means of settling international disputes and a framework for collectively punishing wayward states. This had been tried after World War I when the League of Nations was formed with a strong support from American President Wilson. Ironically, it was rendered impotent by the refusal of the United States to cooperate with the new organization, and it lapsed into irrelevance by the time the groundwork for World War II was being laid. This new United Nations stated the principles of the organization in Chapter 1 of its charter. The first article of this chapter reads as follows. The purposes of the United Nations are to maintain international peace and security, and to that end, to take effective collective measures for the prevention and removal of threats to the peace, and for the suppression of acts of aggression and other breaches of the peace, and to bring about, by peaceful means and in conformity with principles of justice and international law, adjustment or settlement of international disputes or situations which might lead to a breach of the peace. The second article of the Charter includes the following. All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. You see where I'm going with this? We're now faced with an imminent invasion of a sovereign member of the United Nations by the United States of America. The rationale that the U.S. is using is Article 51 of the UN Charter, which allows for self-defense. But look at the text of this article, which states, "Nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations, until the Security Council has taken measures necessary to maintain international peace and security." The U.S. is stretching the meaning of this article beyond the breaking point and using it as a rationale for attacking Iraq. First of all, self-defense means an immediate repulsion of invading forces from one's territory. It does not mean an attack more than a year after the supposed event and halfway around the world. Daniel Webster, American statesman, defined the right of self-defense more than 150 years ago. According to him, an attack on foreign territory was justified only if the aggressor were able to show a necessity of self-defense, instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice of means and no moment for deliberation. Self-defense does not include the doctrine of preemptive attack that is being promoted by Bush and Blair. They say that it is all right to attack another country if one is threatened by its potential power. This new doctrine would be a recipe for dismantling most of the restrictions on interference in the affairs of other states and take us back centuries. This may seem comfortable for the United States now that it has more military power than the rest of the world combined, but empires are not as durable as Bush would want us to believe. Already this doctrine has been grabbed by other countries that want an excuse to bully neighbors. Israel comes to mind in its defense against suicide bombers. India can claim a right to preemptive attack on Pakistan. Russia can attack Chechnya, and so on. Whereas one can see a shred of reason for preemption behind the situation like that of India when threatened by a hostile nuclear-armed dictatorship on its border, the situation of the United States vis-a-vis Iraq is ridiculous on its face. Most of the world outside of the U.S. sees it as such, but the world's newest empire does not see it this way. And George Bush has recently announced his new doctrine of empire. The U.S. will do as it pleases, with or without international support. On 20 September of this year, Bush took off the gloves in his National Security Strategy document submitted to Congress. He states the U.S., quote, has no intention of allowing any foreign power to catch up with the huge lead the United States has opened since the fall of the Soviet Union, unquote. The U.S. will, according to Bush, use its lead in military power to dissuade any potential challenger from pursuing a military buildup in hopes of surpassing or equaling the power of the United States. Now George has stated openly that the U.S. stands above all other states in terms of military power and that will not allow anyone to even try to catch up to that power. Iraq has been disarmed and humiliated for a dozen years. Its neighbors do not see it as a threat, with the exemption of Israel, which is the 51st American state, so it can be discounted. Going back to the concept of murder in international law, I am not justified in killing my neighbor if he possesses the means, or I suspect him of having the means, of harming me. Can I shoot my neighbor because he owns a gun? Or, to make an analogy with the current U.S. position on Iraq, can I drive across town and kill someone who I suspect of having a gun? No matter what the reputation of this person across town, I have no right to even threaten this person. Under Canadian law, this constitutes an assault if I have the means to follow through on the threat. If the Bush doctrine of preemptive attack were allowed in domestic law, it would solve our population problems in short order. When applied by Bush, let us hope that it does not, likewise, solve the world's population problem, starting with a couple of 100,000 or more Iraqi citizens. It would be constructive to remember that the bulk of those killed in Afghanistan and those who will die in an American attack on Iraq are innocent as those 2,800 who died in the World Trade Center. As it says in the book, thou shalt not kill. Good news, bad news. The bad news is I will not be here for the next two Wednesdays to do this show. The good news is that I have won a scholarship to study at a camp in Pakistan for this period. I have requested that a friend fill in for me. I hope that he accepts and does well. As for you, you will get what you pay for. I will be back. This is CFUR, campus-based community radio, broadcasting in Prince George at 88.7 FM. I am Uncle Don, and this is Uncle Don Reads the Comics. Tune in next week at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesday. Allah Akbar.